for a switch hitter.
Yes.
And that's something that somebody taught you how to do, or you picked that up on your own?
Well, I just picked it up on myself because down at Rockhurst High School and college, they had a short right field fence. So I'd get up there and there'd only be three or four of us practicing. Mm-hmm. And you'd hit the ball, and we'd all like to hit it over the fence. So I started doing that, and I just kept on doing it.
For those of us who never saw you play anyway, just briefly describe your hitting stance, if you would. Open, closed?
I was open. I was open. I didn't look like Musial, or I hit like him. And Mantle was open. But I was not what you call an open stance.
Did you pick up your front foot like Mellott, or?
Mm-mm.
No?
No, I just strode with it.
Okay.
Left foot.
Was there anybody you came up with that on your own. Was there anybody that you saw play that you maybe copied a batting stance or anything from?
No, not necessarily. When I was in the slump, I used to have 900 different stances, mm-hmm. you know, moving around in the box and so on.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe yourself as an outfielder, not only catching the ball, but throwing the ball?
I didn't have a real good arm. And the reason for that was in the football season of 32, I skinned my elbow here, and it went up here and got infected, and I was in the hospital for like, two or three weeks, blood poison and so on. But they had to operate up here, and I don't know what they did. But I never could throw real good after that.
I see. And last, how would you describe yourself as a base runner?
Just fair. I wasn't as speedy as my friend Don Guthridge.
Mm-hmm.
He could fly.
When you were playing, Jim, you became a coach, of course, and a manager later on, but when you were playing, the coaches that they had on the team, either the Indians or the Cubs or the Reds, what kind of instruction did you receive from these coaches, or were these guys did you just sit around and stand around and do nothing, or were you on your own?
I asked Yogi what he wanted me to do, and he says, I want you to coach first base. And he says, just be sure you know how many outs there are.
Mm-hmm.
But Yogi, in my opinion, was a great fellow. To talk about Yogi, to go back when I was in the service, in 43, I was at Pearl Harbor, won the war over there, and then they sent me back to the submarine base in New London, Connecticut. And we had a pretty good ball club. But before we had the good ball club, I was the only professional ball player on the team. And we used to play the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard had about four players that played professional baseball. One of them was Randy Gumpert, a pitcher. And the first game we played in the Morgan City League in New London, we played the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard, they had a better ball club than we did. And I happened to look up in the stands, they just had the bleachers, both sides. They had the bleachers, and there was a Commander Barnes sitting there all by himself. So we get beat 12-3 by the Coast Guard. And Commander Barnes was a 30-year Navy man, and he hated the Coast Guard. So he called me down to the office the next morning. The phone rang about 8 o'clock, and he says, I want to see you in my office right away. I said, what the hell did I do now? So I went down, of course I'm standing there at attention. He says, sit down. He says, I was at the ball game last night. He says, you don't have much of a team, do you? I said, no, sir, we don't. He said, what do you need? I said, I need a catcher, a couple of pitchers, a shortstop, a second baseman, and an outfielder, and a couple of pitchers. He picks up the phone, he calls Great Lakes, and he's talking to a fellow by the name of Gums, Lieutenant Commander Gums at the Great Lakes. He and this Commander Barnes were in the service for 30 years together. So I'm sitting there and he's talking to this guy at the Great Lakes, and he said, you've got a world of ball players at the Great Lakes out there. And he says, I want to get some. And he said, told him the same thing. When I told him, I want a catcher, a couple of pitchers, shortstop. So he said, well, he said, I'll see what I can do. Well, I had corresponded with Gene Thompson at that time, off and on after we'd played at Cincinnati. So I wrote Gene a letter and I said, try to get on this draft that they're going to send to New London, Connecticut. So about a week later, Commander Barnes, and he was in the personnel office, the submarine base of New London. He called me up and he said, come down here. He says, I want to tell you who I've got. He says, they're going to be on their way in a couple of days. So I went down and he showed me the list. He says, you got Joseph Kaczynski as the catcher. You got Gene Thompson, pitcher. Al Shearer was a pitcher. Both had played, you know, baseball. And he said, Eddie Scudini, a shortstop, and Sig Grischka, second baseman. And that's all he had, all he sent me. I said, well, I said, I'm sorry that we didn't get an experienced catcher, because, you know, if you're going to have a good ball club, you got to have an experienced catcher. So they all showed up in a couple of days. Thompson was with him. And who do you think Joseph Kaczynski was? It was Joe Gwynn from the Yankees. So from then on, we had a pretty good ball club. And we used to beat the Coast Guard. So that made Commander Barnes happy. So when the season was over, now this was in October of 44, he called me down in the office and he said, well, he said, now, we're going to keep these fellas around here for next year's baseball season. He said, but after that, they're all going to have to go to sea. He said, now, if the Normandy invasion was just over, and he says, everybody has got to come through this office to be reassigned. And he said, if I get any athletes, basketball players, boxers, or baseball players, he said, I'm going to send them up to you. Every week he'd send me up a boxer. Well, I was the lieutenant in charge of the athletic and the recreation department. So I had it arranged with the boxing coach. I said, now, he's going to send these boxers up to me. And he said, I'm sending them over to you. And if they can box, we'll keep them. If they can't box, you put them in the ring with one of your good boxers. And if they can't box, back they go for reassignment. Well, these kids would go in and the good boxer would knock them down a couple of times. Well, back they'd go for reassignment. So in the middle of January, snow that deep, He called me up and he said, I'm sending you up a boxer and a baseball player. And hung up. Only about 10 minutes, the two of them were standing in front of my desk. And here's one guy that weighed about 190, 195, and he had no neck. And he was the funniest looking guy you've ever seen in a sailor suit. And the other guy weighed about 140 pounds. So I looked at the big guy here and I said, which one's the boxer? And the little guy says, I am. So I said, you go on over to the gym and report over there to the Chief Esposito over there. So now this guy's still standing there and he's not looking me in the eyes, looking over my head like this. I said, that is. I said, have you had any baseball experience? He said, yes, sir. He kept looking over the top of my head all the time. And I said, what is your name? He said, Lawrence Barra. And I said, where did you have any baseball experience? And he says, I played at Norfolk. Well, hell, it hits me that I knew what a Norfolk was, a Yankee farm club. And I says, isn't Norfolk a farm club with some big league team? He says, yes, sir. He says, the Yankees. And I said, who was the manager? Well, I knew who the manager was. It was Ernie White. And I said, who was your manager there? Boom, he says, Ernie White. Well, in the meantime, I got an ensign over here that had been to Pearl Harbor with me when I was shipped out from Norfolk, Ray Volpe. And Volpe had been in the Yankee organization for a long time and played with Kansas City Blues. And his ears popped up. Well, Mr. Barra had all of the answers. Now, what I did with the boxers, I can't do that in the snow that deep. So we finally got working out in the early spring. You couldn't get outside up there until the middle of May anyway. So about the middle of April come along. And everybody in the meantime fell in love with Barra. Hadn't even picked up a bat yet. So I said to Gene Thompson, they'd been pitching in the gym and the net, and he was in pretty good shape. So Gene, the first time we went outside, I said, now Gene, put a little mustard on this. We don't know whether this guy can play or not. So he hit two tape measure balls. And I said, hell, I said, we got to keep this guy. So in the meantime, I got to know Yogi, and I said, he said he only played at Norfolk for about 6 weeks when he was 17. And he said he only weighed 160 pounds. Well, he and Gradiola from Dago Hill down in St. Louis, they played on the same Legion team. So I said to him, I said, where did you play? He said, I played in the outfield. Well, I had Joe Glenn as a catcher, so I put him in the outfield. So now we're playing four big league ball clubs. We played the Philadelphia Phillies that Ben Chapman was managing. We played the Boston Braves, and I forget who was managing there then. And we played the Yankees and the Dodgers. No, we played the Giants. And Mel Ott, I had played against Mel Ott, and I kind of knew him, to talk to him. So we dressed at the gymnasium and walked down about three blocks to the ball field. And I walked down with Mel, and Mel says, you got anybody that can play? I said, yes. I said, I want you to watch this guy hit. So on batting practice, I hollered at Mel. In the meantime, we had built a ballpark at New London, the sub base. Yogi hit about two of them right out of the ballpark. He said, "Who does he belong to?" I said, "Who do all those strong son of a guns belong to?" I said, "He belongs to the Yankees." Well, he went back to New York, and he got a hold of George Stoneham, who was the president of the Giants. And he says, "I want you to call up Larry McPhail, old Larry, not the young guy, the old Larry." And he says, "Offer him $50,000 for Lawrence Barrow." And they tell me a couple of years later, you know, that the office connections that I had with the Yankees, he had the Yankee office in an uproar trying to find out who Lawrence Barrow was, because he'd only played about 6 weeks at Norfolk, and then he went into service. So anyway, McPhail said, "If we're going to offer $50,000 for Barra," he said, "we better look at him." So Yogi got out of the service in the spring of 46. And instead of coming to Kansas City, they sent him to Newark. And they wouldn't let him in the ballpark when he got there. He was in his sailor suit. And he's hoping it don't rain back. And finally, Park Carroll was then the general manager at Newark, and George Selkirk was the manager. And they tell me about the remark that they made when they saw Yogi. They said, "My God, look at what they're sending us now." So Yogi went out and the first pinch hit in the first game that he played in and hit a home run. And of course he played there all year then. And then in the fall of 46 is when the Yankees called him up, and he was with the Yankees for years. Mm-hmm. But he was where they got the name Yogi, I think they give it to him at the sub base. And he looked like a Yogi. And I guess that's why they give it to him. But that was it. And then when they played here, the Yankees played here against, no, the Yankees come in and played an exhibition game, I think, in 50 when I was with the Blues, and Yogi had come over to see me and so on, and in other words, he was a pest. You look around, he's standing right there all the time. So then I used to see him every once in a while, and then when I got to scouting, I used to happen to, you know, be in town when the Yankees were playing the A's. And I used to call him up and talk to him. Then in 1964, when he became manager of the Yankees, and when he called me up and wanted me to be one of his coaches, I thought that was one of the greatest things that happened to me in baseball, because I took care of him in the service. So he was 19 years old when I got him in the service. And we, the night that we got beat in St. Louis in the World Series, we went back to New York, and we were walking around waiting for our baggage. And I told him goodbye, and he said, "Well," he said, "I'll see you next spring." So I said, "Oh, going back to big leagues next spring." So I think he says, "I do have a meeting with Ralph Hawk or think it was Dropout. And he says, I got a meeting in the morning. Well, that's when I was getting a haircut in New London, when the guy runs in and he says, Yogi got fired. I thought, holy Christ, he says, I'm out of a job again. And then for him to think of me after me taking care of him in the service, he thought of that. Because I was scouting when the Yankees were here in town one time before they made an announcement that he was going to be the next year's manager from Plan. And he says, you know, he says, I didn't know who to get to be my coach. He says, but I went in to see Bruce Henry, who was the traveling secretary, and Bruce took me down in the Yankee clubhouse, and I knew quite a few of them that were on the team because they had played for me during the, you know, during the minor leagues that I managed. And he told Bruce Henry, when he saw me coming in with the, we were in street clothes, he said, when I saw that guy coming in with you, he said, that's my new coach. Bruce told me that later. But that's about it. And then by the time I got all through and I ended up scouting for Milwaukee from 71 to 74. And then in January the 1st of 75, I retired. Mm-hmm. And I've just been doing honeydews now.
Jim, back in 39, of course, I know you hunting is probably your big hobby, but the Sox and the Cubs played a benefit game for Monty Stratton.
Well, we used to play the White Sox every year. We had a city series for them, and I think I can remember Monty Stratton with the one leg. And I just don't remember that particular game, but I do know that we played them in the City Series. And we might have played another game throughout the season for Monty Stratton.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about a couple of guys that you played with on the Cubs. We already talked a little bit about Dizzy, but I want to ask you about Dick Bartell.
Dick Bartell was just a little feisty shortstop. Not a great shortstop, but I mean he looked like he was feisty all the time moving around. But old Richard, you see, he wasn't there in 38. He was with the Giants.
He was there in 39.
He was in the deal between DeMarie and Jurgis. And another guy went to the Giants for Bartell and Mancuso and Hank Lieber. And then they come over, and the first time I run into them was at Catalina Island. Mm-hmm. But Dick was a feisty little fella.
What do you remember about Charlie Root?
Charlie Root. He says, I'm 40 years old, I'm still pitching. Let me go to the toilet, man. Now this is about Charlie Root when he and I were teammates on the Chicago Ball Club in 1939. Now, he told me this himself. They were talking about the home run that Babe Ruth called a shot on. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, was in the 33 World Series? 32.
Game 3 of the 32 series.
Yeah, because they won it every year, 35 and 38. He said that the Cubs were on Ruth something terrible. Because Ruth come into town, and Mark Koenig was the shortstop for the Yankees for a few years before that. And they traded Mark Koenig to the Cubs. Well, when they finally won the pennant, I think they only voted in Mark Koenig a third of a share or a half a share in the World Series. So when Ruth came to town, he was a good friend of Mark Koenig's, and he was calling him everything for not giving Mark Koenig a bigger share. And of course the Cubs retaliated by getting on him something terrible. So he come up to bat in that particular spot, and Root threw two strikes at him. And they got on him something terrible then, the Cubs did. And he said, that's only two strikes. And he pointed like this. And the next pitch is when he hit it right where that goes. Mm-hmm. Now that's Charlie Ruth told me that out of his own mouth. He said they were on they were on him something terrible because we only gave Mark Koenig a certain amount.
When Johnny Noone was your manager in 38 with Newark, did he ever talk about that unassisted triple play that he made?
Oh, he'd always talk about it. He'd always talk about it. But he was a good manager. Of course, I've always said, you got to have the players to make the manager. And in 37, we had great players that made Oscar Witt the greatest manager in the world. And then in 38, when Noone come in, Noone was another nervous type guy, but he was a good manager and he had good players. We had, from the year before, we had Pinky May was there, Rosar was there, Les Garcella was the first baseman. Mickey Woodick was the shortstop. I don't know who the hell, can't remember who the second baseman was, but in the outfield to start in 38 season, we had Charlie Keller, Bob Seed, and myself, and then Bob Seed went to the Giants, and we had Mike Sartak, which was a pretty good club. Well, we only won the pennant by 10 games.
You played in 40 in Chicago with Zeke Benura?
Yeah.
And what kind of, this guy was an all-star fielder, from what I've been reading. Do you have any funny stories about him trying to catch balls?
No, he wasn't an all-star fielder. But he was a pretty good hitter.
Yeah.
And of course, it was just before the war, and he said his uncle or his father had a banana boat down in New Orleans, and he wanted to send Bobby Maddox and I to the banana island over in the Pacific so we wouldn't have to go to war. But he was a likable fellow, and I often wondered what the hell happened to him. I don't know whether he's still alive or not.
Something that I read about, Jim, that happened in a spring training game in 42 with Lonnie Frey. I was playing second base for the Reds.
Yeah.
And there was a ground ball hit to him. And as the ball was bounding toward him, I guess a taped copy of the national anthem all of a sudden came blaring out of the loudspeakers. And he had bent over to pick up the ball. And when that came on, he stood up because it was the national anthem, took his cap off, and the ball rolled by him. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that.
Anyways, in 64, there was something that happened on a bus in 64 between Yogi and Phil Lins. with the harmonica?
That was the harmonica. That was when we lost four straight in Chicago.
Right.
And Yogi told him where to put the harmonica. When he got on the bus, he was playing the harmonica. And nothing ever, you know, ever happened, but it was real silent for a while. But he raised hell, and then the newspapers picked up all about the harmonica playing. But Linz played in the, he played in the last game when Kubek got hurt. Or Kubek come in and punched himself in the water cooler or something, drained his wrist. Linz helped us win.